When Mr. McNeely asked me for my titles, we go back a long way. We attended Ambassador College together. We're both from the great state of Missouri. I'm from St. Louis. He's from Cape Girardeau, which, if you don't know, is downstream from St. Louis. And he asked me for my titles. And I gave this lecture the title, as you can see, All You Need to Know About Europe in End Time Prophecy. And I didn't realize he was actually going to print this. This was meant initially a bit tongue-in-cheek. It's a catch-all for you, because obviously in 45 minutes we're not going to cover everything that's possible to be known about Europe and end-time prophecy. We might call this a part of a semester-long lecture on Prophecy 101. This would be one of the areas that we would talk about. We're going to talk this afternoon in my presentation about two prophecies. One of them is found in the Old Testament, the other in the New. They were given about 600 years apart. The individuals who were the recipients, or who relayed these prophecies to us, both were prisoners at the time they were interpreting these prophecies or given these prophecies. An interesting commonality that both of them have is that neither of these prophecies is dual. If you understand duality in prophecy, there are some prophecies in the Bible that are fulfilled more than one time, more than one occasion, and so we call those particular prophecies dual. Neither of these is dual, but they are gap prophecies. As Mr. Rhodes was mentioning this morning with Daniel chapter 11, there are prophecies in the Bible that are fulfilled for a number of years and then up to a certain point, and then they stop. And then there's an intervening period of years, perhaps a very long period of time, and then the prophecy resumes and continues in its fulfillment. Those are what we call gap prophecies, and that applies to both of the prophecies we're going to be talking about this afternoon. These two prophecies are key to understanding other critical prophecies in the Bible. Daniel 7, for example, is one of the areas that can be understood by understanding the first of the prophecies we'll talk about today, and also Revelation 13, working backwards from Revelation 17, can be better understood once we understand a few things about Revelation 17, where we will be going at the end. So they're very key prophecies, and another thing they have in common, both of them end with Jesus' return. When Jesus Christ returns to the earth, that's the climax or the final fulfillment of both of these prophecies. So for the first one, we'll go to the Old Testament, Nebuchadnezzar's dream given in chapter 2 of that book, Daniel chapter 2. It is a vision. It's actually a dream that the Babylonian king had. Most of us are familiar with this dream, with the aspects that pertain to it. Dreams were an important part of the Babylonian culture, and so Nebuchadnezzar was very interested in knowing what this dream meant. He called all of his wise men, and if you recall the story, we won't be reading that portion of the chapter. They told him, well, king, if you tell us what you saw in your dream, we'll tell you what it means. Which would have been a carte blanche just to come up with anything. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. You have to tell me what I saw in my dream, and then you tell me what it means. Well, they couldn't do that. And so Daniel, who was already selected to be an advisor or some type of a court assistant in Nebuchadnezzar's court, he was able to interpret the dream with God's help, and he clearly identified the source of his knowledge and insight as being the Creator God. So with that, we'll read selected portions of Daniel chapter 2. First of all, in Daniel chapter 2 and in verse 31, Daniel tells the king what he saw. You saw this great image, and it was spectacular. It was grand, and it may have looked something like this. It was a human image, a human being, in contrast to Daniel 7, where beasts are pictured, and also Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, where beasts are involved. The first thing that Nebuchadnezzar saw, and which Daniel interpreted with God's help, was a human statue. And then he told King Nebuchadnezzar, first of all, you saw this image's head, and it was made of fine gold. And that's found in verse 32. Continuing on in verse 32, its chest and its arms were of silver. Working our way down from the head of the image on down to its feet. Verse 32, once again, its belly and its thighs were of bronze. And so in our depiction, it may have looked something like this. And then in verse 33, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And then while as Nebuchadnezzar viewed this, Daniel telling him what the legs and the feet were, the legs exclusively of iron, the feet partly of iron and partly of clay. Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar what he actually saw in verse 34. You watched, you saw this image until a stone appeared. It was cut without hands, which implies it was not of human origin. It was of some other origin. And as the later interpretation that God gave Daniel shows, it was of divine origin. A stone was cut without hands, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. So in his dream, Nebuchadnezzar may have seen something like this. The image being struck by a stone made without human hands. And what was the result of that in verse 35? Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And that stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. I'd like to call your attention to the use of the word mountain in this verse. It's very important as we will go on. This is Prophecy 101, very basic material we're covering, for many of you, perhaps for most, a review. But the use of the word mountain in this verse, verse 35, is a key to understanding Bible prophecy in general, as we will see. And so in verse 36, this is the dream. This is what you saw. You saw this great image comprised of these various components, and now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. Verses 36 and 37, which I will excerpt. You, O king, Nebuchadnezzar, this is the man to whom Daniel is speaking. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. You are this head of gold. So the top of the image, that's already been identified as the first part, the head of gold. That's Babylon. And you see here on the image a replica of the Ishtar Gates. It's found in the Pergamon Museum in what used to be East Berlin. It's now right in the center of Berlin. Babylon was excavated in the early 1900s by a leading German archaeologist, and a number of the stones that were in the processional street and in the gate were brought to Germany. And the lower stones that you see here in this image are actually original stones from the Ishtar Gate. And in the Pergamon Museum, if you stand with your back to the opening here and look down, obviously they can't make the processional street the way it was in ancient Babylon. It was well over a quarter of a mile long and I think something like 30 yards across. But they have a miniature of that using on the lower levels, as you see here, the lower stones are all original, and they've been complemented by stones made in the same color. The great Ishtar Gates of Nebuchadnezzar's day, He was that head of gold, and the Babylonian Empire, as many of us know, ended in 539 BC when it was superseded by the next part of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. So Daniel continues in his interpretation, and before we go on, I'd like to call our attention once again to what Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar. He said, "You are this head of gold, you, King Nebuchadnezzar." And yet he's referring to a kingdom. That's another important aspect of biblical interpretation, as we will see. The equation king equals kingdom. In Bible prophecy, those terms are often used interchangeably. And if we flip on to our next text here from verse 39, Daniel tells him, "But after you shall arise another kingdom." So he tells Nebuchadnezzar, "You in person are this first kingdom. You are the king. And after you shall arise another kingdom." So you see this interchangeability, king and kingdom. "After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours." That was the Persian Empire. The Medes and the Persians under Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon in 539 BC. Babylon considered to be impregnable, undefeatable. And as the story goes, Cyrus the Great diverted the water from away from the gates so that the city gates didn't have to be opened. His soldiers simply marched up the riverbed and on into the city. And on this cylinder here, which dates back to King Cyrus of Persia, there's actually a record of his conquest of Babylon. So on this particular cylinder, Cyrus the Great recorded his defeat of Babylon. So King Cyrus, or the Medo-Persian Empire, is the second of the various parts of this image, this human image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. The first is gold, the second is silver, and Daniel told him, "After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours," silver not being as valuable as gold. And as we progress, we will see that the metals decrease in value, but they increase in their strength. So after King Cyrus of Persia, the Medo-Persian Empire, which dominated the Middle East for approximately 200 years, another king arose. Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, we're still in verse 39, "Then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth." Now at this point, I'd like to interject a thought, because some people who are familiar with history and this interpretation of Daniel 2 will say, "Well, look, the Babylonian Empire never ruled over all the earth. The Medo-Persian Empire never ruled over all the earth. Neither did the kingdom we're going to be talking about here and the following one." That's true. But from the point of view of the Bible focuses, it doesn't exclude all other peoples, because the kingdom of God eventually will rule the entire earth. But in its focal point, it centers in on the Middle East. That's what the Bible focuses in on when it talks about the earth in many of its prophecies. And all of these powers we're talking about were world powers by their own right in their day, and certainly regional powers by our standards today. Their extent was even far beyond what we would call the Middle East. And that's especially true of our third kingdom, the kingdom of bronze. Once again, bronze being in value not worth as much as either silver or gold, but in terms of its strength as a metal, stronger. And so here you see a mosaic of Alexander the Great, the man who led this third kingdom, a kingdom of bronze. He died in Babylon at an early age, in his early 30s, supposedly of a fever. There are speculations as to what his illness might have been. And in a very short time, within 10 years or so, he had conquered the Medo-Persian Empire. His military force was, in terms of numbers, In most of the battles, I think it's safe to say, Mr. McNeely can correct me on this, in all of the battles where he faced the Persian leaders, the Persian generals, his military force was lesser in number, but it was quicker. They were more maneuverable, and so with superior tactics, usually using a flanking move, he was able to defeat the Persians. And then the Greek Empire, centered in Greece, in Athens, became the dominant power in the Middle Eastern and Mediterranean region, and it remained so until about the first century A.D. And in verse 39, if you're reading with me in Daniel 2, we'll put that up here on the screen. The fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. So the Roman Empire came on the scene. All of these empires succeeded each other immediately. There was no gap. The Babylonian Empire was succeeded immediately by the Medo-Persian Empire. Alexander the Great defeated Medo-Persia and became, in his time, his very short lifetime, the dominant power in the Middle East. And the Greco-Macedonian Empire was replaced or displaced by the Roman Empire, the fourth of these kingdoms. Notice here in verse 40, I'd like to call your attention to that, the number or the descriptive term, the fourth kingdom is mentioned. This image is comprised of four kingdoms. There aren't five, as one other major Sabbatarian group believes. If we allow the Bible to interpret itself, this is the last mention of a number in conjunction with this figure, the fourth kingdom, and it comprises the legs, the feet, and the toes. It is referred to as being the legs of iron, and iron crushes everything and shatters it, and its toes, feet and toes, are made of iron and potter's clay. Obviously, iron not being as valuable as gold, silver, or bronze, but by the standards of the time, a much stronger metal. And it's interesting, the course that the Roman Empire took, it simply subjugated by force the areas that it conquered or ruled over. In 218 BC, as Rome was on its ascent, a man named Hannibal came from Carthage to attack Rome. The issue was over free trade or the free movement of trading ships in the Mediterranean Sea, and the Romans were already trying to impose restrictions on trade on the Mediterranean, dictating that they would be the ones to control trade, tariffs, and these kind of things, tolls. And the Carthaginians wanted to be able to continue to trade freely as they had, and so a military conflict ensued. Many of us know the history. Hannibal attacked Rome from the north. He crossed the Alps with something like 40 elephants and a force of 50,000 men, 40,000 foot soldiers, and 10,000 cavalrymen. And historians have long wondered why, once he came down from the north, from the what today would be the Alps, he defeated the Roman forces four times in quick succession north of Rome, but he never attacked Rome. And then he withdrew, and historians have always wondered, well, why? And one conclusion that they have come to is that Hannibal had made his point. Hannibal had shown the Romans that Carthage was a force that could be contended with. There was no sense in pursuing this any further, and so they reached an agreement. Well, that lasted a short time, and then the legs of iron simply crushed Carthage. So that wasn't the answer that needed to be given to Rome at that time. So the Roman Empire, the legs of iron that crushed everything. Here you see a shot of the Colosseum in Rome. The ancient Roman Empire reached its zenith about 100 AD, and then in its waning years, it was divided into an eastern and western half in 395 AD, and the western half fell in 476 AD. They were overrun by Germanic tribes from the north. And we continue on from there to Daniel 2, verse 41. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Now in the past, some of us may have heard the interpretation or the tradition that the Roman Empire was divided because it stood on two legs. Now, I'm not going to say that's incorrect. It did stand on two legs, but remember that the arms and the chest of the image, which pictured the Persian Empire, and also the midsection, which was eventually divided into four, there is no numeric correlation there. The reason why the fourth kingdom is pictured in part as being divided is because of the feet and the toes and the substances of which they are composed. They're composed of two things that don't mix, iron and clay. So Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, you saw the feet and the toes, they're partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, and so that kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay. And so he sees this, the lower portion of the image. It's not a single metallic substance as the rest of the image. This is a mixture. And he goes on to tell him, and as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, Daniel 2 and verse 43, they will mingle with the seed of men. I'd like to call your attention to verse 43 because this is the first time that a plural pronoun is used in reference to what this image stands for. Up until now, it's either been he or the kingdom. And all of a sudden, in verse 43, Daniel switches in his interpretation that he's received from God and uses the word they. What they? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. They will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And we'll go back to the image we saw earlier, the image of the stone, which then fills the entire earth. It strikes the image on its feet. It fills the entire earth and becomes a mountain. And you'll recall that just a few minutes ago, I pointed out that that's an important term. And verse 44 tells us what it means. A mountain in biblical language is a symbol for a kingdom or a nation. In this particular instance, it's the kingdom of God, which grows and eventually fills the entire earth. So that's an important key to understanding Bible prophecy. The term mountain refers to a kingdom or nation. In this prophecy, it refers to kingdoms. And we also saw that the terms king and kingdom are used interchangeably. Now, the next text I have on here, this is a composite of Daniel 42 and 43. We're not reading it straight through, we're just excerpting it. The toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay. And if you read these two verses and you ask the question, what is the antecedent of the pronoun they? So it has to be something that's used in the plural. The noun that's used in the plural is the toes. The toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, which kings? Well, it can't be talking about the head any combination of, let's say, the head and the chest, because Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, after you. And then he said, after the silver kingdom, after that one, there will be a third one. And then there will be a fourth one. So in explaining what the four individual parts of this kingdom are, Daniel is talking in chronological terms. A succession of kingdoms. One follows the other. And yet, in talking about the final part of the kingdom, Daniel says, in the days of these kings, multiple kings, once again, they and the toes. The toes, they, and these kings are all referring to the same thing. So if we think about this image, if we summarize it, it's talking about four individual human kingdoms, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire, the head of gold. And we'll just say for the time being that the fourth kingdom culminates with the return of Jesus Christ, the stone that strikes the image at the bottom part of the image. Another point we will make is that the chronological order of the image is from top to bottom. The first of the kingdoms is the head, so it begins with the very top of the head on down to, say, the neck where the Babylonian Empire is represented. And it continues then chronologically, looking at this image from top to bottom, on down to the feet. And if you look at a human being from top to bottom and you proceed that way, the last thing you're going to get to are the toes. And the stone is pictured as hitting the image on its feet. And I submit to you that it strikes the feet primarily on the front portion of the feet where the toes are, because looking at the image from top to bottom, that's the last part of the image. And the toes are in the plural. They're referred to as they. And going on in the sequence of the text, kings are referred to in the days of these kingdom, these kings. Now, when we got dressed this morning and you put on whatever it is you covered your feet with, I'm pretty sure most of us, I know there are exceptions, but most of us look down upon 10 toes, right? Most people, whatever it is, 99.9 some odd percent, have, by the normal course of things, 10 toes. So that's the end of our first prophecy in Daniel chapter 2. And as I said, the four human kingdoms here, representing in a sense the entirety of human rule over the Middle East, the region, from that time, the time of Nebuchadnezzar, on down to the return of Christ, that is all supplanted or replaced by the stone made without hands, picturing Jesus Christ, his return, and the establishment of the kingdom of God. And it's also interesting in thinking about this that the image crumbling, all of these governments symbolically are put in an end when Christ returns, picturing the replacement of all human kingdoms at that time. So we'll go from there to the book of Revelation, John's vision in chapter 17. And John sees a beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, it's not our point today to analyze the entirety of this beast. We're concentrating on the part of it that is at the very end time. It was mentioned this morning by my colleague, Mr. Rhodes. He sees a beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. And those 10 horns, as we will see, represent 10 kings. We're in Revelation chapter 17. And he may have seen something like this, an image like that. We won't go into describing the beast in detail, but it had 10 horns, and I had to count twice. There are really 10 horns on this thing. And so Daniel is told, the 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. There are also 7 kings. This is Revelation 17 and verse 9. 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. Now, it's not our purpose today to analyze the time flow of prophecy, but this is a definite point in time in the fulfillment of prophecy, and it also dates the book of Revelation. So this would be an interesting subject to analyze in the future, when a period in human history occurred when five of the heads pictured by the beast in Revelation 17 had fallen. They had become history. They were no longer existing. One was in existence, and one was yet to come. Now, we already established the fact that as we look at these heads, they are called seven mountains. And from Daniel 2, and from other places in the Bible, we know that mountains are symbolic of nations or kingdoms. And so, John was told there are also seven kings. The kings equal the mountains, and mountains are synonymous with kingdoms. So all three of those things tie in. Kings representing a kingdom, mountains also representing a nation or a kingdom. Now the verse we just read, this particular one here, let me go back, shows us that the seven heads, I'm just going to touch on this briefly, they do not exist simultaneously. Because we're told five of them have already come and gone, one is, and there is one yet to come. So they don't exist simultaneously, and they're not the focus of our attention for the moment, but I just wanted to point that out because by contrast, as we read now in verse 12, Revelation 17 and verse 12, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. And we're told in verse 13, these are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war with the Lamb. The Lamb, obviously a biblical symbol for Jesus Christ, and the Lamb will overcome them. So the ten horns, John just tells us that by his interpretation, they are also ten kings. The seven heads represent kings, but they are representative of individual kingdoms or nations or however we want to call them, but they don't exist simultaneously. But the ten horns do exist simultaneously. And they cede their authority to a central power, which Revelation 17 calls the beast. Now it's interesting in Daniel chapter 2, verses 42 to 44, where it's talking about the feet and toes of miry clay. In the King James Bible and in the New King James translation, the word used there to describe the mixture or the mixing of iron and miry clay is the English word mingle. I'd just like to point out to you as an interesting aside that in the Luther Bible, which was translated or completed about 75 years before the King James Bible was translated, the Luther translation then having become the unifying effect on the German language, the today's written German language, which is called High German, is largely the result of the unifying effect of the Luther translation of the Bible, which was completed in about 1530 or so A.D. And in the Luther translation of the Bible, the word used for the relationship between the iron and the miry clay is the German word marriage. They will marry each other. But it won't be a solid union because iron and miry clay don't mix. So in contrast to the legs of iron, which are made of the same metal, and we're told about those legs of iron, that they crush everything that opposes them, we find that the feet, and especially the toes that we're talking about now, these final ten kings, they are a mixture of miry clay and iron, and they will cede at the end time their authority to a central power. Marriage is a contract, as you know. It is, you might say, a treaty of sorts. between two individuals who enter into marriage. So these 10 kings who are described at the end, they are going to cede their authority to a central power. We also notice that the prophecy shows they don't exist yet. They will exist for a very short time, 1 hour, which in God's frame of mind is a very short time. And we see the same thing about these 10 kings in the image of Revelation 17, the same thing about them that we see about the 10 toes of Daniel 2, verses 42 and 43. They are defeated by Jesus. So that's the commonality that Nebuchadnezzar's dream has with the beast image that was revealed to John in Revelation chapter 17. Both prophecies describe an end-time power comprised of 10 kings. In Daniel 2, it's the toes of the image, referred to as they, and that they are struck by the stone made without human hands. And in Revelation chapter 17, they are 10 horns or 10 kings, which exist simultaneously. They cede over their power to a central authority, and they are defeated by Jesus. So we reach these conclusions. The 10 horns of Daniel 2, excuse me, the 10 horns of Revelation 17 are, in terms of their prophetic interpretation, the same thing as the 10 toes of Daniel chapter 2. In Daniel chapter 2, the 10 kings are the final stage of a future resurrection or reviving of the Roman Empire. Because the main force of the ancient Roman Empire ended in 476 AD, pictured by what I would submit to you are the two legs of iron in the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. And then we have a gap of some 1,500 plus 1,600 years, something like that. And we move on down to the feet and finally to the toes, because that's the part of the fourth kingdom that will be in existence when the stone appears. Now, we're going to skip a whole bunch here, but historians will tell us that the Roman Empire was revived a number of times between 476 AD right on down to Mussolini's time. Mussolini himself declared a resurrection of the Roman Empire. And throughout history, after 476 AD, on down to Mussolini's time, it was with the added adjective of holy, the Holy Roman Empire. So it was in existence at various times, and it will have a final stage right before the return of Jesus Christ. And this final resurrection of the Roman Empire will not be established by conquest. Instead, it will be governed by treaty, by agreements, or as the Luther Bible renders it in Daniel 2, by marriage, which is the same thing as a treaty or a contract. So that final resurrection of the Roman Empire, pictured by the 10 horns and the 10 toes, will be roughly in the same geographic area as the Roman Empire has always been, in Europe. So we go to today's European Union, which, as I said this morning, is not the final resurrection. It is a precursor to it, I am quite sure. It currently is made up of 25 countries, which together have a population of 462 million people, 50% more, roughly, than the United States of America. And it is unquestionably the world leader in international trade. 12 countries who are now European Union members have formed for several years now what the Europeans call the Eurozone, with the common currency. And as Mr. Rhodes was pointing out this morning, the first time in modern history that a nation has actually given up its currency, ceded that to some central authority. On January the 1st, 2007, Slovakia will join the Eurozone, and most likely 1 year later, the country of Lithuania. But the Europeans are having a number of difficulties in proceeding on. Last year, as you know, the French and the Dutch both rejected the proposed Constitution for Europe, which is designed to streamline operations within Europe as the European Union grows. This is a step that should have been taken prior to the admission of 10 new members on May the 1st, 2004. Because the current decision-making process for the European Union allows any of its member countries to veto any proposal for a change in Europe's structure or any new thing that Europe might want to do. Any country within the European Union, as it's currently set up, can veto whatever the European Union wants to do. So a small country like Luxembourg, with 1/80th of the population of Germany, if it chose to do so, can simply blockade whatever reform process would be initiated. And that's why the European Union needed this constitution, because it was intended to revise the decision-making process and make it a two-tiered process. As long as a majority of countries within the European Union, it was similar to our setup in this country, it had to be 60% of the member countries comprising at least 55% of the population. As long as they would agree on something, then a change could be implemented. But right now, there's still an absolute veto power given to each country. And so Europe is a bit confused as to how it's going to continue on. Just the last couple of days, there was a European summit during the Austrian presidency of the rotating Council of Europe. Every 6 months, one of the 25 countries takes over and has the initiative in proposing changes and streamlining things. And the Austrian presidency ends June 30th. In the last couple of days, there was a summit meeting. The failed European Constitution was once again brought up. Pressure is being exerted on France and the Netherlands to revise their stance. And Jean-Claude Juncker, who is the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, made the comment on Thursday evening, right before the beginning of the summit, because he fully expects that the British, if there ever is a referendum held in Britain, it's been put on ice, the British will reject the treaty. He basically said that if the British reject having a European constitution, Europe can get along just fine without them. And that caused a bit of a consternation prior to the meetings. But no agreement was reached. Everything remains as it was. So what's on the future for Europe? In May 2000, then German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer gave a speech in Berlin. He said it was a private speech. He was not speaking as a representative of the German government. And he talked openly about what is called today a core Europe. As Mr. Rhodes mentioned this morning, and this is already possible by treaty within the European Union. This has been possible since the Maastricht Treaty, which was reached in the early 1990s. Within the European Union, it is possible for various members of the Union to agree among themselves that they will progress individually as a group towards full political, military, and economic union without the others having to agree. That possibility already does exist, and it is my opinion that that is currently the most likely scenario for the future, that within the 25-nation European Union, later possibly 27 countries, there will be a core Europe which will proceed on. Some people ask, who have understood our prophetic understanding for years, well, the book of Revelation talks about 10 kings. How's that going to work? Well, the last word hasn't been spoken. We don't know what the final configuration is going to be. It certainly will not be all 25, or at a later point, 27 or 28 countries within the European Union who will form that final union that the Bible refers to as the 10 horns of Revelation 17, who will give their power over to a central authority. So as we look to the future, it's imperative for us to watch Europe, to watch for the final stage of that dream that Nebuchadnezzar had some 2,500 years ago because that will have a major impact on the entire world and also on us here in the United States.